Piled High and Deep is back with the journey of a rock and roll drummer turned English professor who has found himself back with the band. During the week, he helps kids learn to write. On the weekends, you can find him and his college buddies tearing it up on stage.
I love music and I loved pursuing it, but it was always like, well, I had to get my homework done first so that I could, you know, have a good time or whatever. Right. And it still is that way. I like the even though when I get to play now, it's kind of like I try to keep it separate. I've got to do my job. When my job is done, I can go have fun with the rock band.
Today we're piling it high and deep on an English doctorate journey that wasn't that expected Chaucer, Joyce, or Vonnegut type of study. Instead, it looked at how literacy instruction was used to preserve the economic, political power, and privilege of white racism. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. You can check out my website at themountaingeek.net. On Twitter, we're at PhD Podcast. And on Facebook, Piled High and Deep, the podcast as well. Our music today is from American Football. That's the band our guest plays drums for. The cut is Desire Gets in the Way and is from the second album from the band. They just released it in October. You'll hear more from them at the end of our program. I also want to give a shout out to my dear friend Andy Schneidkraut. He owns Albums on the Hill in Boulder. He helped arrange this get together with Steve and I. Andy is also helping me put together a couple of other upcoming programs. If you get a chance and are up in Boulder, Colorado, check out Albums on the Hill. It's a classic record store. Well worth your time to go check it out. Enough talk. Let's start shoveling.
By the way, Steve, I got to tell you, this is my favorite place.
Oh, wonderful.
I still get excited coming over the hill, yeah. Over the mesa, coming into Boulder. Yeah. The other part-time job I have is I'm the public address announcer for the CU women's basketball team.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't know if Andy told you that or not, but so I never get tired of coming to Boulder.
Yeah.
And it was funny. I was walking up the steps, or I walked into gate 11 here, and I walked up the steps, and, you know, 30 years ago, I know I had a class in here 30 years ago for something, whatever it was. So, anyway, Steve, thank you very much for joining Piled High and Deep podcast. When I first started thinking about this idea of Piled High and Deep, one of the underlying things I wanted to talk about was as much as the journey that somebody takes, but why is postgraduate education still important in today's age? Because I think we still are really trying to come to grips with the issue of how important is college? Right. We're seeing so many trends of kids getting out of high school directly going, you know, they're going down that computer programming route, right, et cetera. But at the same time, the difference from when you and I went to high school, and I'm about to turn 50. I'll leave it to you to disclose your age, but there was still vocational training in high school,
right?
And we had this idea that college is so important,
right?
And in doing the reading and preparing for our interview here, it seems to me that those are directly questions you're asking,
right?
And talking about the preparation of young minds to serve once they get out, once they finish not only high school but college,
right.
And I think that there are direct paths that need to be addressed both ways in how we're teaching kids to go that route. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. I mean, you're as we were, you know, getting set up here, and you were talking about some of your interests in speaking with PhDs and folks who are using their training, you know, explicitly, and then other folks who are using it in, you know, in different venues and different kinds of ways. You're asking fundamental questions about what it means to be educated and what's the purpose of education. And I think, you know, this is absolutely at the center of my job here. You know, after we get done here today, I'm looking at a set of papers, and you know, trying to figure out the best ways. They're not exactly what I was hoping for, so I have to go back and ask myself questions. What have I given these students in order to, you know, to help them be successful? This is a hard thing that I'm asking them to do. That's just one instance of what goes on here every day as we're trying to figure out what can we do to help these students be successful in the short term, but also in the long term.
What is it? What's your job title here? What do you do at the University of Colorado?
So I'm an associate professor in I have a split appointment, the program for writing and rhetoric in the English department.
Okay.
And so day to day, I'll teach classes. I have some administrative responsibilities. I'm an associate director of the writing program. And I, you know, one of the things I sent along was a piece that I've done about the future of higher education
right.
in a world where tenure is eroding. We think about that a lot here, what it means to teach on a campus like this without the protections of tenure. I have tenure myself, so I'm in a privileged group, but most of the folks with whom I work don't. And so we're trying to figure out what that looks like in the short term and the long term. But I work a lot with undergrads. My research, I've done a fair amount of work with the issues of race and racism in the writing classroom. Anymore, it has to do with these issues of labor and tenure, what education is for, those sorts of things.
So it seems to me, in what I read, and what you've just said, is that the work that you're doing, when you think of English, a PhD in English, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of old Professor Prodfoot, who was, you know, the first college professor that, you know, kind of blew my mind. I don't know what his PhD was in, but, you know, whatever it is, you know, English, it was more than just what you would think of as a typical, you know, in-depth study into 18th century English, right. you know, issue, you know, writing right. issues. I'm not articulating it well, because you know you start thinking about those things and it's way too much to think about. But it seems to me that you're exploring these issues more from a structural standpoint, yeah. maybe like an engineer would attack, looking at a problem. You're looking at it in the same way, but in terms of how kids are taught.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never heard the engineer analogy. I really like that. So rhetoric and composition evolves alongside English departments and often in English departments. And so here we have a direct relationship with the English department, and my tenure home is in English. But rhetoric and composition is more interested in sort of practical issues. So there's a social science strain in rhetoric and composition. There's an education strain in rhetoric and composition. Our training is a little bit we dip our toes in a number of different fields. So while my work sometimes resonates with English in the way that you described, it also touches on these other kinds of fields. It evolved as very much as a practical kind of discipline. And so we are concerned with how writing instruction works, how it evolved, how we can do things more effectively. I shouldn't say we. There's a lot of we's in writing composition. My right. version of the we, I suppose.
Right. So are we talking about, when I had to diagram sentences in middle school and high school, which is where English just lost, you know. I wanted to read and I wanted to write. Yeah. And I didn't care about, you know, my dangling participle right. or you know, where did the predicate belong. Has the teaching of English changed? Yeah. In that way,
some of my best friends are sentence diagrammers, but yes, no, it's changed. It's changed a lot. And truly, I think one of the central questions, beginning in the 70s and 80s, in the strain of the field that I would most closely align myself with, is trying to understand reading and writing as kind of holistic practices. And first and foremost, you learn to read and write by reading and writing. And
right.
So classrooms that have students engaged with interesting and difficult material at times, and then giving writing assignments that help them understand and break down and process that difficult information. One of my favorite scholars in this field is a guy named Mike Rose. I can go on and on about different. There, Victor Villanueva, Keith Gilliard, folks who Janet Emig, Nancy Summers, lots of other people. But I'm enamored with the kind of early and mid '80s version of this set of questions. How do you take people who might not naturally like the academic project or feel like they're good writers or anything like that? How do you help them to understand that, no, there's a whole set of skills that you possess that you can use There's a whole set of skills that you possess that you can use to break down complex problems and do something with them. And moreover, these are skills and sets of abilities that you're going to use 10, 15, 20 years down the line. And a lot of those folks, too, as I mentioned earlier, are really interested in what does it mean for mainstream institutions to educate diverse populations. So that's a fascinating question to me as well. As what does it mean for a first generation college student to come to a place like CU Boulder? What is that the same enterprise or a different enterprise as somebody who you know who's the third or fourth generation right. to go to school? What does it mean if you're from a non-white or non-mainstream background to come to a place like the University of Colorado Boulder?
Because
how does all that work?
Yeah, listen, I love this institution. I bleed black and gold. I'm here for football games, I'm here for basketball games. I love this institution, but it is truly the whitest place on earth.
I can say, I've been here 12 years, that I really do believe that this institution, and I'm not just saying this because maybe right. I'm supposed to, they're trying to understand what it means to diversify here. But it's not, its history is its history, and its present day is its present day. It's not CU Denver. But it's also not a lot of Research One institutions and other places that have a more diverse right. Student body. So I do think I'm friends with folks in the SASE program, Student Academic Services Center, Miramontes. I know folks who teach in those programs, and there are a bunch of programs that are really trying to identify, say, first generation students, invite them to campus, make them feel as though the campus is inviting. But there's a long history here, and it's not just going to go away when we blink our eyes and say that it's fixed or right. whatever, right?
It's also not as a result. I understand that the university has been trying for years, right. ever since, I was here in the 80s, been trying. Right. It's more of it's the general population of the community surrounding it that also has challenges.
But you can't talk about this place without talking about Boulder.
Absolutely.
You said at the beginning, I love this place. And we live about an hour away as a function of not being able to afford it here.
Yeah.
And so, okay, but that to pretend that doesn't impact students' perceptions of this place. I live in a predominantly white area. It's rural, but I ask my neighbors, or they ask me what I do, and when I say CU Boulder, they just sort of roll their eyes, and they have a whole set of associations mm-hmm. about politics, but also about money and sort of worldviews associated with this place. The students of color with whom I've spoken and faculty who work extensively with students of color on this campus sometimes say the same thing. Oh, Boulder, that's that place, or I don't belong, or that's, you yep. know, whatever it is. To pretend that we can't think or that we can divorce what's going on campus from the immediate environment would be silly. At the same time, this is I love this place, and I feel sometimes even a little bad saying how much I love this place because it's so beautiful and it's so cool, and on its best day it's this really interesting and kind of provocative environment. And so to help make it so that more people feel like it's theirs, I think everybody benefits. And so on a good day, this is this is both my favorite place to be and my favorite challenge to think through. And on maybe not the best day, it's a different kind of place.
Yeah.
But I like you, I still get excited coming here. In 1991, you were graduating. I got on a train. I was a freshman in college. On spring break, I scraped together $200, and I'm like, I'll just go down to CU Boulder and somehow convince them to give me a full scholarship. I went to the admissions office, and the guy's like, what? Why are you here? What the hell are you talking about? And I went home and realized that you can't just, stupidly talk my way in. But I desperately wanted to go here as an undergrad. And so, ironically, here I am now, and I don't think I have to go anywhere for a while. So there's an attraction. I think people... a certain kind of person I was attracted to this place. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. Sorry.
No, it is part of the topic because it goes where I want to talk about next is where did you grow up? And what I want to find out is how did you go from elementary school, junior high school? What was home? What were the influences of home yeah. that led you to this? So yeah. where did you grow up?
In the Chicago suburbs, my father was a Chicago public school teacher, and that I think has something to do from when I was a very young kid, watching him think through questions of, honestly, of race and economics and privilege. I could talk about him for a long time. My mom worked at a local paper starting when I was probably 8 or 9 years old in the graphics department in a field that no longer exists because
right.
they had to hand cut the ads and lay out the paper and that sort of thing. But I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, was always very good at school. I can say that. And as we were joking before, that doesn't necessarily mean a smart kid, but right. good at school. Those can sometimes be two different things. And just kept going and going and, you know, wanted to go to, always thought I would go to college. So I went to DePaul University for 1 year, transferred down to Illinois, and just kind of hung around. My senior year, I was an English major and had taken a crack at engineering, didn't do well, but kept a math minor just to finish out credits. I had also always been a musician, and so I started playing in rock bands my junior, senior year, and honestly decided to apply to graduate school so I could stay in Champaign. There was a pretty vibrant music scene, and I didn't know anything else and didn't necessarily want to know anything else. I thought, oh, if I go to graduate school, I can stay here and keep doing rock bands. I had thought increasingly about trying to teach English. My father was a teacher, and so I thought, oh, you know, that's something I'd like to do.
Did he teach English?
He was a math teacher, and so he taught in Chicago public schools, as I said. So I understood what a teacher did, but I still remember calling him and saying, hey, I dropped out of the engineering school and switched to an English major, and I held the phone far away from my head because the screaming was so. Jarring that I remember that vividly. But, you know, I sort of convinced him, and to a lesser degree, I suppose my mom, she was much more supportive, I suppose, that, hey, I'm going to get a job. You know, I'm not just sitting around doing nothing. This is something I really want to pursue. I think he kind of learned to accept it. But my motivation for going to grad school was as much to stay in Champaign and play the drums as it was to pursue this other thing. But as I was given the opportunity to teach as a master's student at University of Illinois, I got to teach one of the classes I'm teaching right, you know, pretty regularly here on campus, freshman composition. Boy, I fell in love with it. I love working with 18 apathetic or sometimes even openly oppositional students who don't think they want to be there, who either think they already know how to do this or are so terrified of it that they want nothing to do with it, to help work with them for 16 weeks to present problems that I think that they can solve through writing. Show them that they can and will succeed if they put the effort into it. That's been truly a 20-year passion of mine now. So I fell into it, but I love it.
I'm going to focus real quick on high school. So your dad's a high school math teacher. Were you in the same high school that he taught at?
Well, no. And in fact, that's one of my early exposures to thinking through issues of race and racism. So my dad taught at a place called Schurz High School, which in the 80s and early 90s, it's in Wicker Park. I don't know if you know Wicker Park. Wicker Park is hoity-toity, okay, million-dollar places. Well, it wasn't. White flight happened in the late 60s, early 70s. In the 70s and 80s, Wicker Park was a very economically depressed area, filled mostly with folks of color, African-American folks and Latino folks. So he would drive every day from the Lily White, Arlington Heights. Arlington Heights is notorious. There was a Supreme Court case in the late 70s. Arlington Heights would not allow Section 8 housing. Right. So you can look that up. But he would drive from there to the city every day to teach, leave at 5 in the morning, come back. And I once asked him when I was in junior high, I said, how come I don't go to that high school? And he said, you don't. We'll have that conversation another time. He himself was a Chicagoan who had moved out to the suburbs, I think as part of white flight. And so racial dynamics in Chicago are fascinating. And from a very young age, I couldn't articulate even the questions, much less the answers. But I was constantly thinking about who lives down there? Who lives out here? Who travels back and forth? What does education do? He took me to Schurz a couple of times. He worked later in his life in the detention center when kids would get suspended. They could still come to school and work on their classwork in the detention center. He was quite good at it. He's a big guy, big, loud, boomy voice. The kids called him Lurch, like from the Addams Family. He's just sort of this big, monstrous guy. But, boy, he was awfully good at that. But I remember going as a kid and interacting with, these were my peers, right?
Right.
In age. But, boy, they saw me as from another planet, in some ways vice versa. Like, they would tease me and ask me questions, you know, what are you doing? Or, like, we were from such different social worlds that place would have eaten me alive. You know what I mean?
Right.
These are kind of tough city kids with a very different orientation to school, I would say, than what I had. You know, I was just sort of, I'll just do whatever and kind of, you know, go from class to class. But, boy, again, I didn't really understand how issues of, say, of race or economics played into it, but I just remember feeling, we're so different. And in some ways, that difference has stuck with me ever since. And I don't know... I don't know where I'm going with this necessarily, because no one's asked me about this, but it's a fascinating thing to think about, what it meant to grow up in the burbs, have a father who taught in the city, and kind of move back and forth between those
subconsciously
worlds.
It certainly made an impact.
Absolutely it did. I mean, I look around at these books, and lots of them have to do with issues of race and racism and language, and I must have been thinking about that without having the language for it since I was real little.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, one younger brother.
Is he an academic type?
Oh, no. No, he's probably, I would say he's taken freshman composition or started it 5 or 6 times at probably 4 institutions, and he's never finished. Okay. He's in the auto, he does auto body stuff and auto mechanic stuff. And as we were talking about before, he never had much use for formal school. And so he's found a very different kind of path for himself than I did. And but in some ways, I think is able to make a living, a different kind of living.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of living. Yeah. Listen, we're not all built to go to college, and I think that we'll talk about that as well. So, you said you started at DePaul, that's in Chicago.
Yeah,
and then went down to Champaign.
Mm-hmm.
Was the college decision based on, I just wanted to be close to home, or and then you decided, I don't want to be so close to home kind of thing?
Well, I had, on the one hand, I had a notion of what I thought college was like, and I had been to Champaign once or twice for science fairs and things, mm-hmm. and I thought, that's what college is like. It's a town, you know, there's all this going on. I was, as I said, good at school, and so DePaul was offering a lot of academic scholarships for students in the Chicago metro area. And so they kind of, I don't know if I applied or they actually reached out, but it was the kind of thing where we'll give you, it was cheaper to go to DePaul,
right,
than it would have been to go downstate. But after a year, in retrospect, I wish I would have stayed because it was a fantastic place. It was urban campus, liberal arts school, but I wanted this thing that I thought college was supposed to be. You know, campuses like this have always been a prime attractant to me. You know, there's a football we're in the football stadium now. There's a football stadium. There's things going on. And so I went down to Champaign. I transferred down after a year and never left. Did my master's and did my PhD there.
That's a little...
Which you're not supposed to
right,
do.
Yeah,
absolutely. Totally a bad idea. But
we'll go down that path. But I think that in terms of at least just reading the abstract from your dissertation, it makes sense for what you wanted to achieve in your research to stay at perhaps the same institution that you did your undergrad work at.
Yeah, well, the longer I hung around, so I was in the master's program, and I had started working with they had something called Bridge Transition, which was a summer / first and second year support program for first generation college students. So again, I was in this same kind of world. Those students tended to be students of color. They tended to be working class students and a very different kind of demographic than much of the Illinois campus, frankly. And so the more I was teaching in that program, I was asking these same questions of myself 10 years later. Oh, so where are these kids? You know, who are they? Where do they come from? How do they relate to the campus or not? And then when I needed to pick a topic for, this is what I'm talking about, this, when I needed to pick a topic for the PhD dissertation, somebody said, you know, there's a whole box of documents down in the basement that give the history of this, essentially what was the Bridge Transition program. So the longer I was in it, I kept asking questions. Well, what does it mean to invite students to a campus in the writing program in particular and then say to them either, hey, you've got the linguistic skills you need, or hey, you don't. And that became the basis of the dissertation and then the book. And the book basically argues that U of I, in the immediate aftermath of King's assassination, they had been talking about a school desegregation program for a long time. But within 2 weeks of his being assassinated, they built one. They had been hemming and hawing for 5 years about what would it mean to have kids of color on this campus, what would it mean to desegregate. And then basically somebody in the administration said, if we don't do this, we're going to have riots on our campus. And then they built this program magically. But the history of the program was interesting and fraught because, on the one hand, they would invite students in and say, hey, welcome. On the other hand, they'd say, well, your language is wrong, or your writing skills are wrong, or you don't really belong here. Push them out the door, either fail them or make them feel unwelcome in other ways. And so the first year writing class became a sort of a flashpoint for how U of I did or didn't desegregate. So I can say staying there was a huge boon, because I knew, if there's one thing I knew, it was that campus. And if there's one thing I knew, it was the contemporary manifestation of the program that I was studying historically. So it became a kind of, you know, as the ethnographers say, and now, as they say, and I forget how they say it, you know, a kind of deep immersion in the culture of U of I, right, that I think at least made me aware of the kinds of thing, the questions I could ask about that project. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So the title of the dissertation is Sponsoring Educational Opportunity, Race, Racism, and Writing Instruction at the University of Illinois. And it's to read that, my degree was history. I kind of go, that's a history.
Yeah.
That's a study of history, not of English.
Right.
But when we go back and I make the analogy of, you're looking at it from an engineering standpoint of structure, then it makes much more sense that it is an English focus.
You should have been at my tenure case, because they were asking the same thing. What on earth does this have to do? It's an institutional history. And so in rhetoric and composition, there's a subset of folks who are really fascinated by institutional history. So it is it's a historical account of the way in which writing programs have evolved. So if you're talking about piled higher and deeper in terms of asking esoteric questions with very narrow answers, in some ways, you know, it can't get more esoteric and more narrow than this. Right. People ask me, you know, if there's copies of books behind you, people ask me, can I read it? You know, my mother asks, hey, let me read it. A friend of mine in the music world is like, hey, give me a copy. Absolutely. And I ask him 2 weeks later, did you get through it? And, you know, no. On the one hand, it's very esoteric and very narrow. On the other hand, I think it's absolutely essential to understanding where we are in the current academic moment to do this kind of thing. Because if I want to understand how this campus right now is inviting international students like crazy onto campus, what are their success rates? What are we doing for them, and what can we do better? It's the same set of questions when I ask of administrators here. So you're going to China, you're going to the mainland to invite students to come here. What supports are you giving them, especially for their language, especially for their ability to read and write effectively at an academic level? Well, guess what? The questions, they're not exactly the same as what we were asking in the late 60s and early 70s at Illinois. They're not that different, though, either. And what role does ethnicity, background, language use, race, racism on this campus play? And in what ways are the issues a little bit different? So asking historical questions, as you know, if you don't know the history, you're doomed to repeat it. And I think that in that sense, this topic is not esoteric at all. It's very timely and, I would hope, very relevant.
Go ahead. Yeah, the questions are flooding. First, are there others like you? Oh, that sounded bad. Are there others that are doing the same thing on other college campuses?
Same thing in what sense?
In terms of looking at the history, learning from that, and then making decisions to ensure that you don't repeat those same errors.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, specifically, you know, it was interesting. On my way up, I was listening to a great interview, the podcast, Mark Maron. Mm-hmm. He was interviewing Paul Beatty.
I don't know Paul Beatty.
I'd never heard of him either. Author, but he was talking about the transition that he made into college, young African American, and where it's gotten him to his success today as an author. And I hear that, and he made a comment during the interview that talked about how young men and women of color today have this view that their older generation had it harder. And his comment back to the student in the interview was that, no, you actually have it harder, because we didn't care what we said then. We just said it. And today there's more judging and more, there appears to be more rules about what kids of color can say, so that maybe they can still, I don't know, it's hard to sit here as the white guy to try and understand what they're going through. So how much is that going to affect the kids' ability to succeed?
Right. I mean, you're as the other white guy in this interview. Yeah, you're asking hard questions. That, on the one hand, that I don't want to speak for students, but I do.
But you can because you deal with them every day.
I'm interested. I'm trying to think if I can if there's an example that I can talk about in a general way that won't implicate anybody. But okay, so a couple semesters ago, I was teaching a first year class, and there was we were talking about issues of race and racism in a general sense, and there was one student in particular. I won't say so that the student is identifiable, but I did ask the student afterward. I'm like, well, you know, I don't know what that conversation, what we did or didn't accomplish in that particular conversation. If you'd like to tell me what your thoughts are on that conversation or whether you thought it was a positive one or a negative one, I'd love to hear it. And if not, I don't want to make you, you know, I don't want to hold you responsible for having a particular view one way or the other. But the student said in sort of general terms, actually, I appreciated that because it was good for me to hear students on this campus being honest about their views about people of color. It was a strange conversation, right. We'll say. And there were a couple comments where I went, oh, my God, why am I asking this, but what am I doing to challenge this particular viewpoint? And I felt like in some ways in that particular conversation I had sort of failed. But in talking with the student in my office, he sort of said, at least if I understood him correctly, yeah, I've heard this kind of thing before. It was in some ways it was useful to hear it articulated openly,
right,
and out front, so that I know what I'm dealing with. Let's say, that doesn't tie exactly back to what you're talking about because issue, but it does. It does touch on what is the responsibility of a classroom to deal with tough issues of race, issues of class,
well,
issues
yeah.
of racism. And I mentioned, you know, before we're globalizing on this campus, right? Is that the do international students face the same kinds of prejudices or not as students who are born here in the States in terms of what this campus can afford them or not? And that's a whole interesting set of questions, too. So the classroom is the space or is an important space for us to come together as a community on a campus like this one and have an open and frank discussion. And so what I took away from both that conversation and then a subsequent conversation with that one particular student was that, well, it wasn't a pleasant conversation, but maybe it was at least a potentially worthwhile conversation. And I think that's a big part of my job. So if I know the history of race and racism on one campus, hopefully it just helps me to do a better job of trying to ask good questions, manage the conversation, and then know when to let it be, 30, 40 years later. And you had asked, there are other people doing these sorts of histories too, in my field, and if I were smarter, I would have researched. I would have boned up on their names, so I could tell you exactly who they are. But yeah, people do this.
That's not necessarily important, but we kind of jumped ahead here, and we'll circle back around to the dissertation, but I do want to get back to the master's. So you stuck around Champaign because you were playing in bands,
yeah,
and you were living, you were starting to live, or you were on the cusp of living a dream as a kid, I'm guessing.
Yeah, sure.
You played music in high school. I think you said the trumpet.
Yeah.
And then you moved on to drums.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, what rock band really needs
a trumpet player? Yeah, right, exactly.
Although there are some pretty good horn players in rock and roll. So how are you balancing your academic responsibilities or goals with music back then?
You know, they were sort of different worlds, and one was the excuse to pursue the other. So I can say both my mom and my dad were very adamant. We started taking music lessons when we were little, both my brother and I. I started probably when I was 5. So I have a 5-year-old at home. We're debating whether to start him.
You got to.
Not. But music lessons was also, we didn't go outside or watch TV or have any fun until our homework was done and our music, and we had practiced for the day. We had an allotted time. This was our disciplinary, you know, right, training at home. So that stuck with me for the rest of my life. So I love music and I loved pursuing it, but it was always like, well, I had to get my homework done first so that I could, you know, have a good time or whatever.
Right.
And so master's study
was, all right, I'm going to work real hard at this. You know, I know that I need to get a job or whatever. But when I'm done with that, then I can go have fun with the rock bands. And so it just become this kind of split consciousness. And it still is that way. I like the even though when I get to play now, it's kind of like I try to keep it separate. I've got to do my job. When my job is done, I can go have fun with the rock band.
So what was the success that you had playing music?
None. We were, you know, this band, I was probably in 20 bands in Champaign, and either they broke up or I said something stupid and got kicked out of virtually all of them. I was especially good at sort of causing,
well,
being confrontational.
You're a rhetoric teacher.
Causing trouble. No, I was the worst possible rhetorician. I just leave it all balled up and then I'd yell at somebody and they'd punch me, whatever. I deserved it every time. I won't lie about that. But music was the center of social life. It was the center of sort of, I loved music biography as a kid and still do. It was a kind of an intellectual passion of mine. I met my wife at a Cowslingers concert. They're a rockabilly band. We still have the T-shirt at home. You know, it was everything socially. You know, my sort of intellectual passions, whatever. And so grad school was, work. I knew I had to work hard and stick with it. But it was there are two different worlds. But the rock band itself, we never had any success. None of the bands I was ever in really had success. Maybe a good night would be to play for 100 people. But it was, you know, it was as important to be there doing it, not really knowing why. And then, you know, this weirdness has happened 20 years later where it's come back as a thing when it wasn't ever a thing when the first time around. You had joked, oh, we had the brass ring and let it go. We didn't even know what the brass ring was, much less, you know, letting it go. But it was just a set of social activities that involved music and lifestyle and everything else. And the fact that it's come back in the form that it has is just sort of a minor miracle, I would say.
So the band that we're talking about that you ultimately had success with is called American Football. Mm-hmm. Five guys?
There were three of us originally. Now there's four.
Okay. Were you all the same age, all doing the same thing, all in master? What were you?
The two guys that I started American Football with were a little bit younger than we. They were my brother's friends, sort of, actually. My brother had introduced me to this world. So as I said to you, I was taking music lessons and studying the trumpet. And so my first year in DePaul, I was in the jazz band and taking jazz classes and whatever. This punk rock, indie rock scene, it was called emo. I don't know if we use that term or not so much as just sort of it was local music. Everybody involved in that I knew was a little bit younger. But my brother would be like, hey, you got to come see this. And I had grown so tired of trying to study jazz. I was starting to realize I wasn't a terribly great trumpet player and didn't have much original to say. He took me to one of these concerts in particular, and it was like a bolt of lightning because they didn't care. You know, whether they could play or not was secondary to the fact that they were on stage going crazy. As it turns out, every time I hear this one band in particular that the singer of American Football helped to start as a drummer, it's like spiritual. It's still, to this day, it's like it just taps right back into me feeling at that particular time like, oh, my God, I need something new musically, and it was like this lightning bolt. So they were younger. I was in graduate school when they were freshmen in college. So a friend of mine was teaching Steve Holmes, one of the guitar players, as a freshman while I'm playing in a band with him or whatever, you know. Right. It was just sort of weird. So I was like this creepy old guy hanging out with these young kids. But I got increasingly involved in that scene, and we were able to play, you know, the little bit we were able to play, like we could drive to another college campus. Grinnell in Iowa, we drove for a long weekend, that sort of thing. I still remember those gigs. It was again, music and social scene and sort of intellectual passion all rolled up into one. That they were a little bit younger. The band broke up when they graduated and wanted to go back to Chicago and start their lives. So Steve went on to do some more master's work, and Mike started doing solo music. He wanted to be a solo guy. So he does a band called Owen, and that he's the one person associated with this that's been doing music ever since. And he's quite renowned as a solo artist. But we made the album, literally finished recording, and never played again.
Really?
Yeah, and so that... The record label put it out, Polyvinyl Records, I think because Mike was still associated with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, maybe we'll sell a few because Mike's doing solo work. But as time went on, it just kept selling and selling. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it sold more than 100,000 copies to date, something like that. And we didn't play a single note after it came out until 2014. Not a single note. So I don't know what magic the internet does or doesn't do, but something happened. And it just sort of became this thing. But it was a weird flash in the pan. It was something that we did in a on a lark on Tuesdays and Thursdays right before there was some show that they always watched. So we had to be done with practice so they could watch their show. And it just became this thing. And it's been interesting to watch it continue to be a thing.
Had you given up on music?
I know, because you had mentioned before, the radio is a little bit like a drug.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's one way to put it, and it is like a drug for me, but it's also, I think, a sweeter way to put it is to say it's just a fundamental part of identity.
Mm-hmm.
I've always played the drums. I've been probably in 8 or 10 attempts at things out here, but nothing really took. I have a couple good friends. We did some original music. I wish it would have seen the light of day because I liked it. But I was in a Doors cover band around here. Sort of. I don't know how things were lining up fate wise. But about a year before American Football, I hadn't been on stage really in a long time. But I, just by some weird circumstance, got involved in a Doors cover band with a kid on campus who was a ringer, like an excellent, excellent imitator of Jim Morrison, like crazy. I couldn't tell the difference on a good night, but in terms of delivery or he imitated his voice perfectly, his mannerisms on stage, the whole thing. And it was fun. I mean, it's lame. I know the guys in the band, everyone else is like, you can't talk. The Doors suck, you know, and cover bands are lame. I get it. All those things are true, except it wasn't. It was super fun.
Right.
But that's the closest I got to any kind of regular playing in Colorado. I had also gotten tenure at that point, so I felt less nervous about doing it.
Right.
You know, and I benefit from tenure in the sense that it still makes me nervous to talk about this, all of this other stuff, honestly. But I think I can say with a straight face that I do my job, I do it well. I have these extracurriculars, they're fun, they inform each other in some ways. But I think I'm trying to be responsible about it. But if I didn't have tenure yet, there'd be a harder argument to make. And somebody'd say, wait a minute, you spent all that time doing that other stuff, you know. But no, Colorado had been a different place. And so this is all the more a miracle that I get to fly home with these guys that I knew from Illinois and do this, you know, thing, whether we're rehearsing or whether we're playing here or overseas or whatever. It's weird. It's a weird thing.
What, you said you have a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
I'm looking up there on your wall.
Yeah.
You got two kids.
Yeah. The other one's about to turn 3.
Yep. Okay. That's a balancing act there.
I have an awfully understanding wife who, for all sorts of reasons that weren't really of our choosing, is home full time. But I can say that the rock band thing in its current manifestation has also been something of a supplemental income for us. And so it's on the one hand, I think I know it's a strain when I'm gone. If I work all weekend, then I'm gone for the whole weekend. It's exhausting for her. But in some ways, I think at least we've come to a temporary agreement that the money from the rock band helps us. Like, they have a college fund because of American football. So God bless college funds. Because I don't know. You know, we could talk about that too. What college costs and what it's going to cost by the time my 5-year-old is, you know, is ready or whatever.
Right.
But it's this weird. It's this weird 3-part world. But I did write a piece that I didn't send to you. I suppose if you're interested, I could. It's under review right now. But back to our original question. What's education for? Oh, go ahead.
No, the one last thing about the band, and then I'll try and let it go. Are your kids going to join you in Europe this summer?
No.
Oh, okay.
it's too expensive. You know, they may come. There are a couple gigs. They may come back we're doing something in Chicago. They may come back for that because we're from there. We could see family. I'm debating whether to take them out to Seattle because there's a campsite associated with Sasquatch. Yeah. It would be sort of fun. I think they'd have a good time. But what I was going to say before, I went to Champaign in 92 with a vague notion that I wanted to be in Champaign.
Right.
Spent almost 15 years there playing in rock bands with some vague notion that it was important to play in rock bands, that I liked this.
Yes.
Went to school with some vague notion that it's important to be working hard at something, right? Went down there, tried to meet women with the vague notion that there was probably one that would tolerate me. So I wrote about this, and I've talked about this to a couple other people, but every time I think about it, it just strikes me more and more. In 2014, about 3 weeks before the shows for this were announced, we had just started talking about playing again. It was in April. I was at home. I had been invited back to Champaign to give a keynote. And this was a big deal for me. It was because they invite people back who they, I assume, sort of perceive as, oh, you know, here's a PhD
right.
who's done what we've asked of him or her, you know, has some, I had just gotten tenure, my book had come out, whatever. So they invited me back to talk to the graduate students. This was fantastic. I went back on a Wednesday. My wife was 7.5 months pregnant at that time, or 8 months pregnant at that time. And I was like, should I do this? Should I not do this? We decided I could try it, but we invited my mother-in-law out. Just, you know, God forbid something happens. You know where this is going. I gave that keynote on a Friday. I met up with American Football for the first time in 15 years. I literally hadn't seen one Mike in 10 years. We rehearsed for the first time on Saturday afternoon. I went back to my brother's house in the burbs, had a couple beers, went to bed. 2 o'clock in the morning, got a phone call. Hey, guess what? Your daughter's coming.
Early.
Early. Jumped on a plane, barely made it. I made it by about 2 hours.
Yeah.
So within the span of 3 days, three things that I had that were rooted in Champaign 20 years earlier, the fact that I had gone to school, the fact that I'd done the rock band, the fact that I'd met my girlfriend and now my wife, 20 years later, within the period of less than 72 hours, had all come to this kind of weird fruition, right? So I had the celebration of the degree. I had this rock band thing manifest,
right,
selling out all these shows and whatever. And then I had a kid. And it was in no way, shape, or form could I have predicted any of those things 20 years previous. But I can only talk about the value of my time as an undergrad at Illinois 20 years later because I've got all this amazing stuff going on.
Right.
And I wonder whether we can't at least do a better job at places like this of helping students to understand. It's not about right now. It's not even about next week. It's not about your first job. If you take life here seriously, you don't know what's possible years down the line. And we were talking about that before, right? You didn't know what you were going to do here that would lead you to
absolutely
be in this office now.
The big question is, what made you go all the way to the dissertation, to the PhD? But you had kind of touched on it before that, you know, you were looking for something to do, but what even made you go, hey, I think I want to do that?
My master's was a master's in education, and I thought I wanted to be a high school teacher. And so to be a high school teacher, you have to sign up for student teaching, you have to sign up for all kinds of practicum hours and those sorts
right.
of things. As I was starting in that program and starting to sign up for some of those courses, and in the meantime taking graduate electives in this program, what they called writing studies program, which was their fledgling. Rhetoric and composition was still a relatively new field at that time. You could get into a program without knowing exactly what you were doing. Students today are much better socialized and have a much clearer sense of what they want to do. So I would never get into a PhD program today based on the materials that I gave them, you know, all those
right.
years ago. But I found myself more and more intrigued by the graduate level classes and less interested in the practicum kinds of things. And honestly, my father said, "You're crazy to be a high school teacher. The hours, the lack of respect, the lack of income. Don't do it." I mean, I heard that message again and again. And I started. So I was attracted more and more to the grad side of things, and hearing more and more, like, here, you know, he retired. He taught till the day he died, but he got increasingly disgruntled with the professional side of things. And again, I just liked Champaign, you know, and I thought, well, I'll just, but, and I don't feel bad saying it. Like, I didn't,
no,
there's a lot of people, I think, in master's and PhD programs who know how to talk about why they should be there, but are in fact there because they're afraid to consider other options and other possibilities. And I was absolutely afraid to consider other options
yeah.
and other possibilities. But again, the classroom teaching is what increasingly drew my passion. I love that stuff. I still love teaching writing to this day. And so all those things kind of conspired together. And the academic job market for writing and composition was quite strong back 10, 12 years ago. There were lots of jobs to be had for people who had done administrative work. I helped to run the writing. Well, it didn't help. I was the director of the Writing Center there for 5 years. I dropped out, actually. I guess I didn't mention this. I quit the PhD program a couple of different times. Right after my coursework was done, I took a year away, and then I almost sort of left a second time. I like the academic admin stuff, so my job was to help run the Writing Center, to do training, to make sure. I worked with another woman named Debra Lomax to kind of keep it running day-to-day. But I was starting to realize that unless I finished the PhD, there was a ceiling to what I could accomplish there.
How was that dissertation process? This is my fifth conversation. nobody's really loved writing their dissertation.
No.
It's not a the actual vomiting on your computer and getting it on paper. That's not a pleasurable thing.
No, it was awful, actually. Yeah, it was fairly awful. I it took me a long time to figure out how to approach this history. It took me an even longer time to figure out kind of theoretically what I wanted to say about it. I wrote a couple chapters, and again, I mentioned the good job market. I went out on the job market only having completed about two chapters of this five-chapter thing, and guess what? I had a job offer, and that's great. From an advisor's perspective, that's the ideal situation, because then it's just like, well, finish up the dissertation. Well, I had to write more than half the thing while trying to finish up my last year running the Writing Center and imagining what this new job was going to be like, and I did not deal with it well. I make the joke all the time, and I tell graduate students, I punched my hand through a wall at one point and didn't quite break my hand, but I couldn't use my fingers for a while. And I went to the emergency room in Champaign, and the doctor's like, oh, so what happened? He's like, I'm like working on my PhD, got mad and punched my hand in the wall. He's like, yeah, they didn't teach you how to manage stress in that program, did they? It was a terrible thing. So I make that joke with graduate students in part just to help them understand that it is incredibly stressful. It's not a fun process. Writing is not fun. Sometimes it's a terrible kind of awful exercise at times, and I made it worse on myself. I think in retrospect I could have learned to do things differently. It was not a pleasant process. That said, revising into a book was also an unpleasant process. But what the PhD I think teaches more than anything else is how to deal with long-term skepticism or self-doubt or long-term concern about, is this going to actually work? And having gone through the dissertation, I knew when it came to book time, it will work itself out. Whether it works itself out at the timeline where I can get tenure is another question. But I know if I keep at this long enough and keep attacking it from all these different angles, and you teach yourself a writing process where you're at it every single day, no matter what. And when you get frustrated, you put it down and walk away. You don't punch walls. You do something else. You can train yourself to deal with long-term stress and concern. And that got better. And ever since then, I think, that's one of the things the PhD teaches you, is how to feel bad for a long time right. And still get through the other side.
I want to bounce forward here. I remember the writing program, the required freshman composition here.
Sure.
It was the five-paragraph structure, right? Because you had your opening where you introduced your three issues, you were going to discuss those issues, and then you had your conclusion paragraph.
Right.
Does that format continue?
I'm going to give you the usual answer, which is no, we've moved past that, and that's dated, and that's another form. That genre evolved for a particular reason. It actually does a kind of work. And again, my wife taught high school English for a long time. You learn it in high school because it is an efficient way to help you process information. Now, it's so easy that we have to move beyond the five-paragraph essay. If you just write that way your whole life, you look like a high school kid, right? But it's a useful kind of genre. So in my first year courses, I don't teach it. I certainly don't call it that. But I teach, here's claim, reason, and warrant. Here's how you understand evidence to work. Here's how you build basic paragraphs right. So that you can present your evidence and analyze it. It's not all that different from a five-paragraph essay. There are some folks on campus, and I think we agree to disagree, who say that the ways that we use technology, the fact that we have podcasts and other kinds of verbal arguments or multimedia arguments have rendered the five-paragraph essay less useful or even useless. I disagree. I think it's a fundamental way. It reflects a kind of mental organization that I think does transfer across a lot of different modes in media.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my opinion, but I think it's justified by certain strains of research in my field and a ton of experiences that I've had in classrooms where I think it does matter.
I can tell you that as a guy that's been in the professional world, I work in the insurance industry, I still do harken back to that. If I have an argument to be made, because that's what I do for a living, is I argue with insurance companies, I will use that opening, here are the three supporting statements, and then here's the conclusion. So it is helpful in organizing your thoughts, and then the use of bullet points, et cetera, which did not exist in that type of a format 30 years ago. You know, the way I see it, it is relatively new. That's interesting because when I talk to kids who are interested in moving in or looking at the insurance industry, I tell them, know how to write, know how to think, and know how to use Excel. And I think if you get those three things done, you're probably going to be fairly successful in the business or in the commercial world. We often hear that high school, is getting crapped upon. What's the quality of writing coming out with high school seniors? Are the kids in their top 10% of their class, are they really that good of a writer?
Let me answer that question, but let me say one thing to back up before I do. The one thing, this five paragraph essay is awfully important. One thing I've learned from my colleagues in this program, though, and really they've helped me to understand just how powerful and important this is. If you just say that good writing is this five paragraph style, or it's just claim, reason, warrant, evidence, right, analysis, you're missing a huge other chunk of this. Students have to be able to understand when and where to use that,
yep,
and they have to be able to understand different genres and how you translate the skills that I think are inherent to something like a five-paragraph essay to very different kinds of genres. If I'm making a YouTube video, is it exactly the same? What's the same about it? What's different about it? If I want to build a website, what's the same? What's the different? If I want to pitch an email, what's the same and what's different? Grant proposal, these sorts of things. So in addition to helping students understand this basic format, I think we have to teach them to recognize and identify what a genre asks for,
right,
and then what they need to do in response to it. I'm not five-paragraphing essay this thing. I'm not doing a very good job of this on a lot of different levels. But it's a different kind of genre. It's a little more freeform. So it's not argumentative in that same way. So I can feel comfortable speaking my mind a little bit more here. But if this were a three-minute interview, right, I would have practiced my bullet points,
yep,
something more along those lines. So that's something teaching in this program has helped me, I think, to really understand the fundamental importance of helping students understand the genres that they confront, and then when and how to use the skills that we teach them. Now, the question of good writing, there are people in my field who make the joke. Socrates was complaining about the quality of his students' writing. So part of that is actually a complaint about that older people have about the way in which they do or don't understand younger people. So I make the complaint. I make it about rock bands, too. Oh, these kids today, they like the worst kind of music. That's me being... part of it is that. That said, what I will say, I think that the kind of testing regimes that high school teachers are held to and then that students have to endure make them slightly less flexible thinkers.
Yes.
That is to say, they are so... They learn a five-paragraph essay not because, this is a tool that you can use to say cool stuff. Now it's a tool that I got to use because I got to take this PARC test or this other test or the IB exam or the AP exam. I think that has made some of my students less flexible thinkers, or they have to be convinced to forget,
right,
that side of what writing is for before they can say anything cool. I'm telling students more and more at the first year, I'm just trying to teach you to say something interesting. That's all. Because at the end of the day, the difference between you getting a job and not getting a job may boil down to they thought you were interesting or they thought you were boring. It's not about being persuasive. I mean, it's of course it is about that, but it's also about trying to use these tools to ask questions that people find engaging in some way, shape, or form. And there's no formula for that. And so I think I love working with students who say, I'm bad at this, or I hate this, or I'm not a good writer, or whatever, because there are steps I can show them and try to say, hey, if you do X and Y and Z, you're going to achieve some level of success. But you also can't teach interesting. At some level, you have to try to convince people be interesting, but it's hard. It's harder to teach that. So I don't think it's like in the last 10 years my students have gotten worse, other than I've gotten older and I don't understand them anymore. I don't know why they're so fascinated with their phones or whatever it is. But that's not. I think there are things like testing regimes and the ways in which they're marched through those. I do think has had some sort of impact in terms of what I have to do in order to meet their needs. If that makes sense.
Yeah. We're going to wind this down. I know. As a writing guy, as an English guy,
your entire life, have you been more, what have your reading passions been?
That's a great, wow, what a great question. I have always loved biography and autobiography since I was little.
Okay.
Something about, and I think, I was thinking about this just the other day in reference to something else. I think those straddle the line between literature and social science, yeah. Right? So a good biography or autobiography invites you to inhabit the mindset of somebody who, whom you respect or love or want to know more about. I'm reading Robbie Robertson's.
Oh, yeah, right. Right, yeah.
I've always dismissed Robbie. Never liked Robbie. I always took Levon's side, right? Mm-hmm. Robbie's a bad guy, whatever. Yeah. He's a fantastic writer. My God, this thing is so engaging. And I'm coming to see, I think, the band's history from his perspective in this interesting new way. So I've always loved that, and I think that that in some ways describes my personality. I have a foot. I don't read a lot of literature. I don't read a lot of fiction anymore. If you want to have reading ruined for you, get a PhD. That's my plug. If you want your passions completely squashed, but I don't have to read literature. What I read is the stuff on these shelves. You know, mm-hmm. these are various investigations of writing, how to teach writing, its history, its you know, social, cultural, racial dynamics, that sort of stuff. So I read that stuff passionately, but I have to for my job. What I read for fun: biography, autobiography, and books about skiing. I love ski maps. I love, there's a book called Potter Ghost Towns that marches you through all the derelict ski areas right. in the state and shows you, you know, how to get to them and, you know, what backcountry gear to bring and all. I love that kind of thing.
You skied Geneva Basin yet?
You know, I haven't, but it's on my list to go up through the Grant side, right? That's the one up on top of...
on Guanella Pass.
Guanella, I haven't. Yeah, I've tried it a couple different times and the weather's been off every time. But
That'll be off mic.
Oh yeah, it's fit. Writing has a whole variety of instrumental purposes, and that's how I've always approached it. There's a guy here, Stephen Graham Jones, a pretty renowned fiction writer. Horror, in particular, is his genre. And I was at a function with him the other day, and he was talking about how if he doesn't write every single day, he starts to sort of physically freak out. Like it's built into his right. DNA. And I didn't say this, and I probably shouldn't say it here. I don't feel that way. There are plenty of days where I don't feel the passion to write the academic work that I do. I feel the passion to play the drums. But that doesn't mean that I can't, that I don't write. I do write all the time. I'm a professional writer, but it's from a more practical perspective, and I'm trying to help students approach it from that perspective. There's an aesthetic side to writing. There's a practical side to writing. You can do one. You could do both. That's the beauty of it, is it serves all of these different myriad functions.
I'm trying to go down that writing path of creative writing, fiction, speculative writing, science fiction. And you just touched on something that I've been kind of trying to balance. Is I find on those days when I write a lot for my job, I'm not interested in my creative writing. Yeah. But when I haven't done a lot of written communication, that's when I get home and I'm just going, the words, they're stuck in my fingers. They have to.
Yeah.
And so that's really interesting. I'm wondering where that'll head off to.
My wife has an MFA in short fiction, and she's been at home with our kids. And I know one of the challenges for her right now is that she feels like she's been away from her creative work for so long that when she gets the time and energy to really go back into it full force, that it's going to take her a long time to kind of build up the kind of momentum that I think she had before we had kids and before this particular situation where I'm here or running around and she's with them, you know, a lot of the time. And it'd be interesting to talk to, you know, to her or other folks who are in the position that she's in, where it's like she feels as though, I think, she's had to put some of her creative ambitions on hold because other aspects of life have required her full time and attention. That's a hard thing too.
We'll wrap this up. As we've sat here and talked, you straddle this line. You've got administrative responsibilities and teaching responsibilities. At some point, that changes. At some point, you will make the decision to move away from the classroom, and it's going to pain you a lot.
I hope not. Yeah, I hope I don't have to. Why do you say that?
Because I'm wondering if at some point, can you make
the greatest impact by stepping away from the classroom. So what you need to say can be said to more people that can make an impact in the classroom.
Oh boy, I'm so glad you said that and put it that way. And my answer is, I hope not exactly. So this is something unusual and interesting, I think, about writing and composition, is there's a whole subset of people, I would include myself in this subset, who do administrative things and who try to, so I help run this writing program. There's a faculty, we are a faculty of 90, and I try to help shape some of what's going on day to day. But I certainly believe, and I know a lot of other folks here and across the country believe, you can't really do that work unless you're also in the classroom because you don't have any credibility that you need to. My teaching load is a lot less than most of the other folks who teach in the writing composition program. So if they were here, they'd be rolling their eyes maybe and saying, yeah, whatever, you teach one or two classes a semester, please. I'm in the trenches. I'm doing the real work at the university. And there's some truth to that, too. So a typical people here teach four classes if they're full-time instructors in the program for writing and rhetoric. I teach most semesters one because I'm doing admin. Sometimes I'll start teaching two again next year. But I never want to get out of the classroom entirely because I think it keeps those dynamics feed on each other. And my research is about classroom teaching typically, whether it's about the labor conditions now or whether it was about linguistic diversity issues earlier. I don't think that work works if I'm out of the classroom either. This place and other places like it, Research One institutions, absolutely need a robust cohort of people whose job it is to keep undergraduates interested, excited, and involved. And if everybody does what you're suggesting for all the right reasons, look, admin is where you make money here too, let's be honest, we do a disservice to that population. And it's self-defeating because, as you know, our state funding, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think we're at 2 or 3% of our budget comes from the state.
Yeah.
Guess where it comes from? Undergraduate tuition,
yep.
At least for the day-to-day, keeping the lights on, keeping the heat or the air conditioning on, yep. Those sorts of things. It's in our best interest to cultivate, and then support excellent undergraduate teaching, whether it's on the tenure track or off the tenure track. I think research universities are going to have to figure out teaching professor ranks, whether they tenure them or not. They're going to have to figure out, we got to reward and really make life good for our best teachers, whether they're doing research or not, in the same kinds of ways, because otherwise these places won't exist.
Yep, absolutely. Steve, have a great time on the road. You've got some great shows with American football coming up.
Yeah, thank you. Weekends and summers.
That's what you got. Yeah,
occasional weekends and summers. That's it.
Do you have a nice neighbor kid that can mow the lawn?
Yeah, We're gonna have to figure that out. We do. We'll get it done.
All right, Steve. Thanks. Appreciate it.
What
your time.
A pleasure. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Steve Lamos up at the University of Colorado Boulder, my alma mater. Always fun hanging out in an office on the edge of Folsom Field. It's in the stadium. His office is in the stadium of Folsom Field. His band is American Football. I've got some links that I'll post on the website that you can check out their music and their tour dates. They're mostly going to be in Europe this summer, but I think they've got a couple of dates in and around the U.S. I did ask him to make sure they try and get to Denver. I'm certainly going to be checking them out. They're in the background right now. That's the tune, Where Are We Now? It's the first cut off of their recent album in October. It was just released in October. Thanks again to Andy up at Albums on the Hill for putting us together. It's really a lot of fun, and I hope to have a couple of more folks from University of Colorado Boulder in the next couple of months. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is a creation of Mountain Geek Productions. Check out the website at themountaingeek.net, on Twitter at PhD Podcast, and on Facebook at Piled High and Deep, the podcast. And if you like what you've heard on PhD, the podcast, please give us a review on iTunes, or if you're using Podcast Revolution or Overcast, whatever application you use to gather up your podcast for listening pleasure, give us a review, would you please? Love to hear from you. And if you know of any PhDs or are a PhD yourself and are interested in telling your journey, please send me a note. Love to get you on a future episode. That's all for today. keep shoveling.